Welcome to IP Management Voice, the podcast spotlighting leading minds in IP and IP management. This series supports the IP Business Academy's call for subject matter experts to share insights, foster reflection, and strengthen the global IP system. Join the conversation via our newsletter and explore cutting-edge content on DPLEX. The content featured in this episode on IP strategy as a foundation for international market entry comes from Paolo Beconcini.
If you're running a business with global ambitions, maybe you're selling niche products overseas or gearing up for a big manufacturing deal in Asia, there is one area you absolutely cannot afford to get wrong, and that is protecting your intellectual property. Welcome to the deep dive. We have just finished working through a massive stack of sources, including some really critical insights from Dr. Paolo Beconcini's guide on global IP planning. Our mission today is simple. We want to hand you the four-step strategic framework you need to protect your brands, your innovations, and your competitive advantage when you go international. Think of this as your essential shortcut through what can be, honestly, a total legal minefield.
What's fascinating about all this material is that it really stresses one undeniable truth. IP protection isn't just some legal checklist you tackle at the end. It has to be a strategic, proactive business decision you make at the very start of any international venture. So we're going to guide you through that process step by step. When you must plan, how you structure that plan, how you execute it, and then crucially, how you maintain that long-term defense.
Okay, let's jump right into the urgency of it all. Why is this a pre-entry issue? I mean, a lot of business owners assume their IP protection at home, say in the US or the EU, is strong enough. They think they can just adjust their strategy later once they see if the foreign market even takes off. Why is that assumption so dangerous?
That assumption? Well, it's the number one reason companies lose control of their brand abroad. We have three non-negotiable legal realities that really demand proactive preparation. The first one is the huge difference in varying rules and customs. IP laws are not the same across the globe. You mentioned the US and EU, and they often operate on first-to-use principles for trademarks. So just using the brand gives you some rights.
Yeah.
But if you look at a crucial market like China, they use a first-to-file system.
So if you wait, someone else, even a complete stranger who has never sold your product, can register your exact brand name first, and then legally they become the owner in that country.
Precisely. And that's where the impact hits hardest. Let's say you invent some revolutionary new gadget and you're planning a Chinese launch for next year. A smart competitor, or even just a dedicated trademark squatter, files for your trademark tomorrow. Now, you're forced into our second big reason. Registration is required for validity. In that first-to-file system, the squatter now has the formal enforceable right simply because they registered it first.
And the cost of that mistake, it's not just lost time, is it? I remember seeing some figures in the material about the financial hit.
Oh, it's catastrophic. The legal cost to fight a single squatter just to reclaim your own brand can easily be 10 times the original filing fee. You're essentially paying a ransom to the squatter just to enter the market with the brand you already built. Your whole market entry is held hostage.
That makes the urgency crystal clear. Now, you mentioned cultural customs play a role, too. The sources talked about how local language can create some unexpected challenges.
They create huge blind spots. For instance, if your brand is only registered in its original English spelling, and local Chinese consumers start using a common, catchy Chinese name for your product, that new translation is what gains commercial value. If you haven't proactively registered that translation, you might find that's exactly what a squatter rushes to register. They cut you off from the local identity of your own brand.
Wait, hold on. So someone registers the translation of my brand name, which I never even use to register myself. That's almost like copywriting a nickname.
Exactly. It's a key insight into local market behavior that you have to factor into your legal strategy. It means you have to think far beyond the protection you have back home. Which brings us to the third point, scope and availability differences. You have to check if the specific protection you rely on even exists in the target market. For example, unregistered design rights, which protect the look and feel of a product without a formal registration, they're recognized in the EU. But they don't exist in the same way in the US or China. You have to adapt.
So, given all this risk, what are the specific triggers that should immediately tell a company, especially a smaller one, okay, now it's time to start spending money on this?
You need to start the minute there is any external evidence of your brand's value in that market. The two most urgent triggers are, one, existing sales, even if they're just unauthorized parallel imports. If your product is moving, there's demand, and you can be sure the squatters know it. You need immediate protection. The second, and I'd argue it's even more critical, is approaching deals with local business partners. Your IPR strategy must be solid before you ever sit down for a negotiation.
Okay, that makes perfect sense on paper. Secure the asset first, but let me play devil's advocate for a second. Securing IP before a negotiation means spending real capital before you even know if the deal will close. How do you manage that upfront cost?
And that's where the strategy comes in, which leads us perfectly into the planning phase. Instead of just registering everything everywhere, planning forces you to prioritize. Other triggers are maybe less urgent, but still important. Expanding into key countries with market potential, or even countries offering attractive IP incentives that you need to secure rights to capture.
That's a great transition. So we accept the urgency. Now, how do we actually structure the defense? The material breaks this down into three essential pillars: knowledge, assets, and budget. Let's start with knowledge.
Right. Planning starts with understanding the unique risks and systems of the local landscape. This means doing deep dives into local IP rules, enforcement practices, the business culture, all of it. You really need local boots on the ground, or at least a local legal counsel, to avoid those common pitfalls we just discussed.
Like assuming your U.S. trademark works in China, or forgetting to register the Chinese translation of your brand.
Exactly. If you don't fully understand the system, you're basically trying to build a fortress on sand. It'll get swept away the minute the first legal challenge hits.
So once we have the knowledge, we move to pillar two. Asset identification. Companies just can't afford to protect every single patent and trademark in 50 different countries. Mm. How do they prioritize?
It's about ruthless prioritization. You have to evaluate which specific brands, which patented products, which trade secrets will actually be used and be relevant in that new market. It's not about protecting everything you own globally. It's about protecting what you will use to make money or gain a competitive edge in that specific place. And this selection process, it really comes down to two factors. First is your industry type. A fashion company lives and dies by its trademarks and designs. That's where the budget goes. But a biotech firm, on the other hand, relies almost entirely on patents to protect its core tech. So that's where their investment has to be.
And the second factor is the business strategy for that specific market.
Exactly. Is your IP used purely defensive, you know, just creating barriers so local competitors can't copy you? Or is it active? Are you trying to license that IP to local partners to generate revenue? That distinction really dictates whether you invest in broad patent coverage or deep localized enforcement mechanisms.
Hey, are you an IP expert with a focused topic you want to share? Then you might be just the right fit to become an IP subject matter expert at the IP Business Academy. It's a great opportunity to build visibility for your expertise and reach new clients through a trusted academic platform. You'll be supported in creating digital content, LinkedIn strategies, and outreach to your target group. If you're ready to raise your profile and position yourself as a thought leader, get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. End of advertisement.
Okay, and this is where it gets really practical. Pillar three, budgeting. This isn't just about filing fees. How does the budget force these strategic decisions?
The budget influences the entire structure. And this is where you start to see the difference between viewing IP as just a cost versus seeing it as an active asset. If your budget is tight, you might have to forget about some defensive patents that only keep competitors out. Instead, you focus on the core trademarks and copyrights that are critical for sales and brand recognition. And you have to budget for the long haul. So many companies make the mistake of only budgeting for the initial filing. You have to plan for potential rejections, oppositions from other companies, the annual maintenance fees to keep your rights alive, and most critically, the substantial cost of ongoing monitoring and enforcement. Without that enforcement budget, your registered right is just a piece of paper.
So we have the plan, the prioritized assets, and the budget is mapped out, hopefully including that crucial enforcement money. What is the one crucial step right before we start the actual filing process?
It's the essential safety check, risk assessment. Before you file a single application, you have to assess your vulnerability to prior rights from existing local competitors. For patents, this means conducting what are called freedom to operate, or FTO, searches. The FTO asks a simple question. Does our product infringe on any existing patents in this new territory?
And if you don't check that, you risk a huge lawsuit the minute you launch.
Exactly. And then separately, you do availability searches for trademarks and designs to make sure your application won't just get rejected by the IP office. One avoids litigation, The other ensures your application even gets accepted.
Once that clears, we move to filing. We talked about acting fast. What are the tools available?
Well, companies can choose between using international filing systems or just individual national filings. International systems like WIPO marks for trademarks or PCT patents, they offer a single application process to designate multiple countries.
Wait, can you quickly just clarify those terms? What do WIPO or PCT actually mean for a business owner listening to this?
Absolutely. WIPO is the World Intellectual Property Organization. Filing a WIPO mark or a PCT patent is sort of like reserving your spot in line globally. It doesn't automatically grant you the right, but it simplifies the whole process. You file one application in one language, and then you designate all the countries where you want protection. But the final approval still comes from each national office you picked. It's a huge time and cost saver, especially when those first-to-file rules in places like the U.S. and China make speed so important. Now, a key strategic point here is the geographical coverage. For instance, an international filing that designates mainland China often won't automatically cover places like Hong Kong and Taiwan. You still need separate national filings there.
That's a critical detail. Assuming one filing covers the whole region could leave a huge gap in your strategy. And what about administrative hurdles, like different classification systems for goods?
Oh, they're significant. When you file a trademark, the goods and services are classified. The international standard is the NICE classification. But China's system, while it's based on NICE, has its own unique administrative and judicial quirks. That can really complicate things if you're trying to protect your brand across specific types of products. You need local expertise for that.
Before we move on from filing, I remember a very specific rule from the source material about where patents have to be filed first.
Yes, this is often overlooked, but it's critical for compliance, especially if your R&D is spread out. Countries like the U.S. and China have rules that require patents to be filed first in the country where the invention was actually made. And why does this matter? Because if you fail to comply with that one rule, it could potentially invalidate your entire future filing strategy around the world. You violated the home country's secrecy rules.
So once we got the registration, we often rely on local partners, distributors, manufacturers. Are our standard confidentiality contracts good enough?
This is one of the most important questions in the execution phase, and the answer is overwhelmingly no. Your standard home country contracts are often totally unsuitable. Simple non-disclosure agreements or NDAs are just not sufficient, especially in high-risk environments like China.
Why not? What do we need instead?
You need something much more comprehensive. It's often referred to as an NNN agreement. That stands for non-disclose, not use, and not circumvent. The not disclose and not use parts are pretty straightforward. Don't share my secrets and don't use them for your own stuff. But the not circumvent clause is the crucial third leg. It stopped your local partner from using the knowledge they gained from you to then turn around and create a competing product outside of your original deal. It prevents them from taking your tech, tweaking it a bit, and launching a parallel product. That's where the real teeth of the agreement are.
Okay, execution is complete. We're active in the market. Our NNN agreements are all signed. But this isn't a finished project, is it? It's an ongoing long-term thing. What are the maintenance duties?
Exactly. This ongoing phase is all about maintenance and monitoring. The maintenance part is obvious. Things like paying your renewal fees on time, mispayment, and your right just expires. But the critical part is the proactive monitoring. You have to regularly monitor the local market and foreign IP databases for any conflicting registrations being filed by other people. You want to spot a potential infringer or squatter early.
Because it's easier and cheaper to fight them during the registration process.
Much easier. Fighting them after they've already launched a product is a whole different ballgame.
And beyond watching databases, we also need to keep tabs on our partners, right?
Absolutely. You have to conduct regular audits of your licensees, your distributors, and your joint venture partners to make sure they're complying with your agreements. You need to verify they aren't exceeding the agreed-upon use of your tech or brands.
Okay, let's talk about when things go wrong and you actually need to enforce your rights. This seems really complex to do abroad. How do you approach it strategically?
It requires setting very clear goals first. What do you actually want? To stop their sales, collect damages, or just block their trademark registration. Then you select the right local IP to enforce and you secure solid evidence. A huge part of this is engaging in what's called forum shopping, where the jurisdiction allows it.
Forum shopping. It sounds a little aggressive, but why is choosing the venue, the court, so critical to the outcome?
Because the choice of court or arbitration body can dramatically affect the result. You have to choose the right law and the right venue in your contracts before a dispute ever happens. Some jurisdictions are much faster. Some courts are known for being more sympathetic to foreign companies. And most importantly, the enforceability of the ruling. The court's ability to actually make the infringer pay up or stop production, that differs widely. A great judgment is useless if you can't enforce it locally.
Let's pivot to the money side. What about when we try to license or assign our rights in a new market? Are there hidden hurdles to actually commercializing our assets?
This is where that earlier planning really pays off. But yes, the hurdles are significant. Navigating these IP transactions requires knowing a lot of specific local regulations. For example, many countries require you to register or get approval for any license or assignment with the local IP office. If you don't register that license, it might be considered invalid or unenforceable. Beyond that, you can run into technology transfer regulations that subject certain deals to governmental approval. And finally, you have to navigate all the complex tax and money transfer rules for royalty payments, which can drastically change your financial return.
So what does this all mean for you listening? We've covered the four pillars of a global IP strategy. You have to plan early, triggered by sales or new partnerships. You have to plan effectively by prioritizing knowledge, your assets, and your budget for the long haul. Execution demands rigorous FTO searches and protective NNN contracts. And then there's the long-term follow-up, constant monitoring and strategic forum selection for enforcement.
The core takeaway here is that this has to be a proactive defense. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it really raises an important question that every company entering a foreign market has to ask itself. Are you viewing your IP purely as a defensive cost? You know, it's just something you have to pay to avoid getting sued and that's it. Or are you strategically integrating it as an active business tool for monetization, for licensing revenue, and for real measurable competitive advantage?
That distinction cost center versus active revenue driver is truly what determines whether your international expansion thrives or fails in the long run. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into global IP strategy. We hope this knowledge empowers your next international move.
Thanks for listening to IP Management Voice. If there's any topic you'd like us to cover in this podcast or on the content platform Dplex, please get in contact and let us know.